From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. We are watching the situation at the airport in Hong Kong, where another day of mass protests has led to chaos and clashes with the police. We're also learning more about what happened in Russia, where there have been funerals for five nuclear engineers who were killed while testing a nuclear missile last week. The missile exploded Thursday at a test site in northern Russia, causing a spike in radiation in the area and days of uncertainty as Russia kept changing its story about the accident. And experts in the U.S. tried to figure out what happened. Let's bring in Here and Now security analyst Jim Walsh. He's with MIT's Security Studies Program. Hi, Jim.
How you doing?
Doing well. So first of all, the Russian response to this explosion seems eerily familiar to the Soviet Union's effort to cover up Chernobyl back in 1986 after that accident. That, of course, was a much bigger explosion. But what do we know about what happened last Thursday?
Well, we're piecing it together, and we got a little more data in the last couple of days. And when the Norwegians check their radiation sniffers, we'll have even more data beyond that. But it is apparent that the Russians are testing an engine that would be essentially strapping a small nuclear power reactor, to a missile. Now, if you think that having a missile with a warhead on it and then strapping a reactor to it is a bad idea, you are correct. It's one that the U.S. played with in the late 50s and the 1960s, and we decided to abandon it because, you know, just at the sort of common sense level, it doesn't make sense to build a flying nuclear reactor.
And the idea is that this missile that they're trying to build could get basically anywhere on Earth.
Exactly. So there are two big different types of missiles. There's a ballistic missile and there's a cruise missile. So the ballistic missile, the one we're sort of familiar with, you lob into the air and it, you know, goes up into space and it hits its peak and it comes down. Pretty easy to track with satellites. The other kind of missile is a cruise missile that flies sort of like an airplane, except it's a rocket. It flies flat, low to the ground, much more difficult to intercept, much more difficult to track. So their idea is, if we build this, no matter what our missile defense is, we won't be able to stop it, and so that will enhance deterrence. This is the Russian view.
Now, as the U.S. looks at this, what's going on in the minds of people in Washington? I mean, are they worried about what Russia just did?
I think most people aren't, because they see it as having a really high level of technical obstacle to overcome. And I'm guessing that some people think if they want to waste their money on something that isn't going to work, fine by them, keep doing it. But it shows a certain level of desperation, and it shows a Russian interest in developing new weapons. And so for this particular technology, probably not worried so much. But if we stand back and look at the big picture, what is the big picture? The intermediate range nuclear treaty, that's gone.
That's the INF treaty.
The INF treaty,
just went away.
Exactly. That's gone. In another couple of less than 2 years, the New START treaty, that the last remaining major treaty that puts limits on nuclear weapons for the U.S. and Russia, that could be gone. I would say that doesn't look good right now. Maybe it'll turn around, but it doesn't look good. So we're in a context in which decades of rules and institutions built to protect us are falling away. Mm-hmm. Both sides are working on new missiles. And yes, there are a lot of important issues in the world. You know, climate change is important. Bigotry and violence are important. But there's one and only one thing that can destroy the United States today, and that's a nuclear war. And we all sort of put that in our pocket after the end of the Cold War and moved on with our lives. This is a little reminder, hey, the nuclear weapons are still here. We may be building more. We need to pay attention.
And what are the rules about testing, by the way? Are countries allowed to do what Russia just did? Because I know that there's even concern in a nearby town where this accident happened that the radiation levels could be high.
Yeah, there's no limits on testing this sort of thing. Now, what we do have for limits is testing on nuclear weapons. There's a treaty banning above-ground nuclear tests, and then there's the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty that severely limits the nuclear testing you can do. And the idea is if you limit the testing, you limit the weapons. But even recently, within the last month, the Russians have accused the U.S. of starting to think about walking back even on the ban on nuclear testing. And that would blow a hole in the nuclear regime as big as this building.
Now, meanwhile, Jim, as we're watching what's happening with Russia, a topic that we talk to you a lot about is North Korea, and they've been testing more missiles even after the two summits with President Trump. And now President Trump said over the weekend that he received another very beautiful letter from Kim Jong-un offering to resume nuclear talks. What's going on there?
I think several months ago, it was little noticed, but many months ago, Chairman Kim warned the U.S., if we don't make progress here, we're going to resume long-range missile and nuclear testing. And so I see these tests both as ways to advance their missile capability, but of equal importance as a political message. Listen, I've got these weapons here. I'm going to go back to testing unless you do what, you know, I want you to do. And so nothing happens and nothing happens.
Which is what? Just remove all sanctions on North Korea?
Yeah, I think – so right now we've had more or less a freeze on big military exercises. But the chief objective of the North Koreans is to get sanctions relief.
That is Jim Walsh here now, security analyst with the MIT Security Studies Program. Jim, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And now to Texas, where in recent weeks, four Republicans who represent that state in Congress have announced they're retiring. Democrats are taking that as a sign that the deep red state might be turning purple, is it? Ashley Lopez is senior reporter at KUT News in Austin. Hi, Ashley.
Hey.
So those retiring include Representative Will Hurd, the only black Republican in the House, the only Republican in Texas with a border district. There's also Pete Olson, Michael Conaway, Kenny Marchant. How significant is this rash of retirement?
Well, it's a big chunk of Republicans. So, you know, if you look at how many have announced so far in the, you know, the entire Republican delegation in Congress, this is almost like half are coming from Texas. So it's a sign to me that Republicans, you know, are have like different calculus when they're considering to run, like something big is changing. Mm-hmm. And that might be different for, you know, different candidates, but there are, you know, some underlying things that are definitely a thread through all these retirements.
Well, people might remember that Will Hurd was the only Republican who, instead of, you know, really battering Robert Mueller at those hearings, asked him about national security. He elicited that line, "The Russians are interfering in our elections as we speak." Hurd seemed to, you know, even then be pulling away from the party line. He said if the Republican Party in Texas doesn't start looking like Texas, there won't be a Republican Party in Texas. Talk just briefly about him.
Well, he's definitely consistently been a moderate voice in the Republican Party here in Texas. You know, there aren't a lot only because, I mean, for a lot of reasons, but mostly because Republicans have been in power for a long time. You know, this is a deep red state, or has been for a very long time. And so Republicans have been able to sort of like walk the line of being really hardline conservatives. But, you know, Will Hurd has been in a swing district, you know, for the entirety of his tenure here, because that border district is very swingy. I mean, it's been in the crosshairs for the Democratic Party for years and years and years. And so, and he also has a lot of like relationships with Democrats. I mean, a good example is actually former Congressman Beto O'Rourke, who's now running for president. Like that was, you know, they took like a, I remember like this like road trip through the country together, and they like, you know, FaceTime live that. So he has been consistently sort of a middle ground in Republican politics, which is very rare.
Well, and he ran that surprisingly close race to unseat Ted Cruz. Cruz ended up winning, but that's when everybody sat up straight and said, wait a minute, what happened here, a Democrat? By the way, there have been calls for Beto O'Rourke, especially when he's been so compassionate after the El Paso shooting. There have been calls for him to, hey, you know, drop out of the presidential race, stay and run for a seat in the state. What's your thoughts on that happening?
Yeah, it's funny because, like, you know, earlier in the year, he was, you know, there was, you know, everyone was like, quickly jump into the presidential race. I think there's a lot of frustration among Democrats that he didn't jump, you know, quicker into that race. And now that he's running for president and, you know, he's not doing as well as maybe a lot of people had predicted he would, you know, they're asking him to jump into what is now a crowded Texas Senate race. You know, I think Democrats smell blood in the water. And so there are a lot of, you know, good candidates jumping in to run against John Cornyn. And so if he'd be jumping from a presidential field, he'd also be jumping into another crowded field here in Texas. And I mean, it's important to remember he's been raising a lot of money, and donors are giving him money with the expectation that he runs for president. So that's a little harder to see happen. But who knows? I mean, I always say, like, you know, you never know what happens.
Right. Well, what exactly is happening in Texas that is changing up the state? Is it demographics, you know, more younger, more diverse people moving in? Is it people moving there from other parts of the country? Is it immigration? What is changing the state?
All of that. It's a lot of different demographic shifts happening all at once. One is, you know, Latinos are set to become the biggest population here by 2022. That is going to be a very important voting bloc. Right now, Latinos don't vote in high numbers, but, you know, who knows? That might not always be true. And, you know, that is a wide open electorate for any party to invest in.
Yeah.
And Democrats are taking that seriously. And then the suburbs are changing. This is a story of, you know, the whole country. But Texas has had immense population growth within the state and, you know, other states, people from other states moving here. And particularly these like fastest growing cities are in suburban counties here in Texas. And those suburban counties are turning blue very, very fast. And so that has changed the makeup of these congressional districts that were drawn almost 10 years ago.
Well, some are wondering if what the impact of the horrific attack in El Paso might be politically. Of course, that's not the first concern. The first concern is healing those people. We'll keep an eye on that. Ashley Lopez, senior reporter at KUT News in Austin, Texas. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The National Weather Service is warning that higher temperatures across Southern California will result in an elevated risk of fire this week. Temperatures expected to be 6 to 10 degrees above normal tomorrow. California has had its share of devastating wildfires, yet every year more people are moving into high-risk fire zones. And after a fire, most people want to move back and rebuild. Molly Peterson from member station KQED reports on the challenge that creates for local officials trying to keep people safe.
Wildfire doesn't just reduce California landscapes to ash. It makes more disasters possible. Like in Santa Barbara County, where the Thomas Fire ripped across the mountains above towns a year and a half ago. The fire burned hillsides bare as heavy rains came. Those conditions let loose a punch. Mud and water flashed down into Montecito, a well-to-do community.
So here was it. We're walking on a house now.
Santa Barbara's former fire chief, Pat McElroy, says the debris flow slapped the bark off of sycamore trees. It bowled sandstone rocks the size of SUVs into a pocket of houses on Randall Road.
Well, this was a neighborhood, and now it's not.
23 people died in mud.
There is no expectation of moving back in.
Santa Barbara County has burned again and again and again.
10 years of fires around here. With the T, the Hezazita, the Gap Fire, the Zaca Fire, the Thomas Fire. It was a really shattering experience.
Again and again and again, they've rebuilt. And these communities are paying a price to stay put. Insurance claims for the Thomas Fire alone totaled nearly $500 million. But McElroy believes next time it can be different.
What was missing in all of these conversations, and not just the Thomas Fire, is in the planning process.
To plan better, he helped form the Partnership for Resilient Communities.
Hoping it doesn't happen again isn't a strategy.
To McElroy, resilient means taking steps to ensure a safe life. And in the town of Montecito, wealthy neighbors have agreed. They've kicked in almost $5 million to install steel nets across creek canyons, the pathways for debris flows. Wires stretch like tightropes, 70 feet across San Ysidro Creek. A helicopter drops down a long mesh net of rings. Crews walk back and forth on the tightropes, linking mesh pieces together like chainmail to pull them tight across the canyon. These nets won't stop debris, only slow it down. There are no state laws or codes or rules to help determine when the price of rebuilding is too high, when pushing into wildlands is too unsafe. McElroy says even places battling back from disaster ignore the tough question.
Because a lot of times now, the fire piece comes in at the end of planning, and it's maybe, how are you going to evacuate? Instead of, should you be building here in the first place?
Are there areas that shouldn't be built? Yeah, absolutely.
Kurt Henke is a former fire chief from Sacramento. He and McElroy argue that if fire officials had more power earlier on every development, people would be safer. Henke says to make that happen, elected officials would have to change the law.
If the last 2 or 3 years doesn't change it, what more do they need to see?
What politicians see are competing needs. People need public safety. They need more housing, and they need local services paid for with property taxes. All those needs compel local officials to say yes to more development.
They don't have the authority to do what they know is right.
Fire scientist Max Moritz is with the University of California Cooperative Extension Service.
And so they have to let some of these developments proceed without being able to say anything about how it could be done better. From the people I've talked to, I know that that's hard to sleep with, really, when you play that out.
Max Moritz says we could do better. I'm in North San Diego County in an area called Harmony Grove in a valley surrounded by steep canyons and ridgetops. These are hazards, and they're on our fire maps. This is a high-risk area. Everybody knows it, and they're going to put hundreds of houses here. They're doing it, construction crews, right now. To do it, the county waived limits on density. They waived a rule that there be two roads in and out. The county says if there's a fire, people can be safe. They can evacuate in stages. That was Paradise's plan. These choices we make about density or roads, they're not on risk maps, but they make us more vulnerable. And Moritz says we overlook our vulnerabilities.
I think it's mature and a mark of intelligence that we can actually say that and say, no, let's do this better, either retreat, or if we're going to stay here, let's do it radically different, different enough that this isn't actually that big a problem anymore.
After that crush of mud and debris slammed into Montecito Creek, Santa Barbara County said everyone who wanted could come back. Claire Gotstanker, who's on a county architectural board, sent one creekside project forward, but she didn't like it.
I said, why do you want to do this? Why, you know, here she was getting her house reviewed, and she can't even get to it.
In trauma, people seek comfort in what's familiar. Gotstanker knows this because 10 years ago, her house burned to the ground, and she pulled the first permit to rebuild.
3 years later, my brain kind of went, no, 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 you haven't really been listening.
She had a stroke, and those years taught her a lesson.
I think it's a terrible time to make a decision. The county, you know, issued these, you know, demolition permits and all of this stuff really fast. And I'm going, slow down. Slow down. Having been there 10 years ago, you need to slow down.
One of the lessons from past flooding and other disasters across the country is there really is this short-lived window of opportunity following a major natural disaster to have some sort of transformative change, to make things different afterwards.
Nicholas Pinter is a geography professor at UC Davis. He studies how communities respond to repeat flooding. Floods are happening more often, sort of like wildfire.
One natural hazard, one big disaster, is sometimes seen as an act of God. It's the second one. It's a 1-2 punch that convinces people that this is a trend, this isn't something they want to deal with again and again. We need to take some kind of a measure.
After a flood, you can fix levees, but Pinter says you can also pick up and move, and he's seen communities seize that moment and become safer because they were willing to consider something new. For Here and Now, I'm Molly Peterson.
And now to the aftermath of another fire in Paris, where reconstruction of the Notre Dame Cathedral is set to resume later this month. It was put on hold because of lead contamination. That devastating fire in April tore through the cathedral's roof, brought down its spire, produced that yellow plume of smoke, which was filled with toxic particles from more than 400 tons of lead as it melted. And last month, a lawsuit brought by the French environmental NGO Robin des Bois, or the Robin Hood Foundation, claimed city officials neglected public health and downplayed the contamination risk. At first, officials were asking people to maybe clean things up with handy wipes, but real research wasn't done till later. No one alerted people in outdoor cafes and bookstalls up to a mile away that they were at risk. And now, some schools have been found to have lead levels 10 times higher than what would trigger an alert. Officials are racing to decontaminate them before kids return. Jackie Bonamois is director of Robin des Bois. Jackie, when did officials figure this out?
Some results have been made during May and June, but they were a secret and they have been published only around the mid of July.
So who and what are you most concerned about?
We have very quickly understood that there was a danger not only in the surroundings of the cathedral, but also in the 6th, 5th, and 7th quarter of Paris,
right,
which are very, very touristic. And it was scandalous to see these workers along the banks of the Seine were not informed about the risks of lead, which was drifting on the pavements, in the streets, and in the public gardens.
Well, and in the Seine. We remember that Notre Dame is on an island. and the Seine, the water surrounds it and leaves the city. Are you concerned that lead will be carried away from Paris?
Yes, yes. The signatory of this catastrophic fire will be visible in fish and shells in Normandy. Mm-hmm. We are sure of that. But for the moment, the main trouble is coming from the cleaning and about the protection of inhabitants and tourists without having been informed of the danger.
But officials are, in the beginning, they may have been saying, take some handy wipes and rub some things down. Now there's full-scale professional cleaning to try to get rid of the lead. Mr. Bonneval, do you have any sympathy for Paris officials? This was so devastating, so shocking, just happened so fast. We all watched around the world. Do you have some sympathy with, you know, them having to deal with this? And
No. We have no sympathy. We do not approve the behavior of the public power. That's why we have filed a complaint against them for endangering lives of others, and our complaint is taken in consideration by the prosecutor. We are not sure at the moment that our complaint will be followed by a preliminary investigation, but we are sure that our complaint is examined by the prosecutor.
That's Jackie Bonema, director of the environmental nonprofit Robin des Bois in Paris, the Robin Hood Foundation, suing the city of Paris for downplaying the risk of lead contamination from the Notre Dame fire. Now there's a scramble to clean up that lead. Jackie, thank you so much for speaking with us about it.
Merci beaucoup. Thank you very much.
Chaos erupted today at the airport in Hong Kong. Video streams from the airport show riot police clashing with the protesters. Today, the city's leader, Carrie Lam, said that violence would lead Hong Kong down a path of no return. Now, we're getting live news feeds from Hong Kong as the story develops, but what are people in mainland China, where media is censored, seeing? Let's bring in Carrie Allen, China media analyst for the BBC. Carrie, welcome.
Hiya.
So how are Chinese media outlets in the mainland of China talking about these protests?
Well, they've been giving more coverage to them in recent weeks since they became large-scale in early June. So what they originally started off, there was a lot of playing down back in June. They were referred to as stray hooligans who were rioting in the area. But what's happened now in recent weeks, they've changed the language. They've now started referring them to a mob. And literally in the last 24 hours have started saying that their actions have shades of terrorism. Hmm. So this is creating a real fear tactic for people in mainland China. And they've only seen hand-picked footage of protesters fighting with the police. So they're under the impression that the police are really overstrained and they're really struggling to stop what they see as almost mafia-like activities in Hong Kong.
Why do you think that change has happened, that the Chinese government and the media agencies that it controls have gone from playing down the protests to talking about them as a mob or even terrorism?
Well, what China does anyway with protests is it normally tries to censor them if they're small scale. But because these protests have continued for such a long period of time and people have gained an awareness that they're happening, the government's realized that it can't censor them. There's mm-hmm. there's just too much going on that it can't maintain the control. So what it's tried to do instead is create its own dialogue. So it's been able to use hand-picked footage and create the idea that these are now riots or, as it's been saying in the last 24 hours, very violent activity that could be interpreted as terrorism for the Chinese people.
And what about on social media? Is the Chinese government able to control that as much as they can the news?
It is, yes, because what China does is it has what's called the 50-cent party. And these are people who are paid a small amount of money to post messages that are in line with the government's message. So it could be poor students. They think this is an opportunity to make a bit of money. And they post en masse. They create accounts and they post messages saying, I support the Hong Kong police. I hate what's going on in Hong Kong. Hmm. And what happens is any genuine social media users, they'll just see floods and floods of messages showing this. And this gives the idea to them that this is the mainstream opinion throughout China.
Is there a sense that the Chinese state media is priming its citizens for an eventual crackdown in Hong Kong?
Oh, absolutely, yes. There's been increased commentaries in newspapers saying that, well, discussing whether the People's Liberation Army should intervene, because under the one-party, two-systems policy, I mean, this is the idea that there is one China, but that mainland China and Hong Kong have two separate governments, right, effectively, that China keeps a step back. It doesn't get involved. So, but what's been happening is because they're building up this dialogue of that for people, Hong Kong's almost out of control. There are more commentaries suggesting that if it reaches a point of unrest, the People's Liberation Army has the power to go in. So it's creating this dialogue. I mean, to use words like terrorism, this really is using very, very strong language, and they've been getting support from local police officers and the public to say that if they do go in, that this is in the better interest of the Beijing, well, in the wider China nation.
That is Carrie Allen, China media analyst for the BBC. Thank you, Carrie.
You're welcome.
This week, we're marking the centennial year of the Grand Canyon National Park. Yesterday, we talked about the geology of the canyon. Today, it's Native American history. The Havasupai tribe is one of 11 Native American tribes that are traditionally affiliated with the Grand Canyon, and they've been living in and around the canyon for many centuries before it ever became a national park. Joining us now from Supai Village is Ophelia Wadahamaji Corliss, who's a Havasupai tribal councilwoman. Ophelia, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, and just so people understand, Supai Village, you are right in the Grand Canyon right now as you speak to us.
Yes, absolutely. I'm looking out my window at these beautiful red towering walls and these lime mesa tops from the bottom of the Grand Canyon here. The ground that I walk on is pretty much river silt, so it's really beautiful and fantastic.
Now, the Havasupai tribe is the only Native American tribe that still lives below the rim of the Grand Canyon. Tell us a little bit about the history of the tribe there where you are in the canyon.
We are the only Native American tribe that lives below the rim of the Grand Canyon. You are correct. And the Havasupai have been here since time immemorial. Traditionally, we had two areas where we lived. Where we live now in Supai Village was our summer home. During the winter time, we lived in bands spread out on the south rim in the area now known as the Grand Canyon National Park. So we migrated between both areas, and down here where we currently live is great land to grow crops, and we would grow them down here through the spring and the summer. We would keep the overabundance and bring the rest of us up on the rim where we would live with our families and probably hunt just a couple deer every year. And predominantly, we had a vegetarian diet. But when we had to go live on the South Rim, is when we would request help and thank our animal friends for helping us live through the wintertime.
And when was that disrupted?
Well, there are some stories in some books where we did meet some Spanish conquistadors on the South Rim. And there's very little documentation. And I wouldn't call that the first disruption. I would say the first disruption is when the Fred Harvey Railway, everyone would remember it as the Grand Canyon Railway, and that group made their way to the South Rim of the Grand Canyon, discovered the area. And by 1919 is when they had federally turned the area into Grand Canyon National Park.
But in 1880, there was a reservation that was set up, correct?
In 1880, they met then Chief Navajo. And that was when we had already been hearing stories from displaced nations who had been coming to the Grand Canyon to hide out, essentially. And we knew they were coming, and we heard the stories that they were coming. So when they got here, we pretty much just put our hands up and said, we'll do what you have to say. Please just let us stay here in our land. And they did. They turned down here, Supai Village, into a reservation, but it was very small. It was like 5 miles by 3 miles. And that original reservation didn't even include our world-famous waterfalls. That was later on given to Grand Canyon National Park.
So as we now reach the 100th anniversary of the Grand Canyon National Park, how does that feel to people in the Havasupai tribe?
I think if you were to talk to older individuals, that they would still have some resentment. The creation of Grand Canyon National Park were actually some of the darkest days for the Havasupai people. We lost a large area of our migration. When we were on the South Rims, that's when we would be in bands to be able to tell our origin stories. And that disruption is still felt amongst families today. But it would depend on the age and who you ask. The younger people that you would ask may not quite be aware of that history yet. But I can tell you that today, the partnerships with the Grand Canyon National Park, we've been working on them for a long time. And instead of resentment and anger, there are these ideas of partnership and collaboration. So we know that although this is the 100th year celebration for the national park, we've been here in this land, in that area, since time immemorial. And in fact, we still have a population of Havasupai tribal members who live inside the national park. They decided to stay, even through the long history of struggle with the national park and them trying to push us out of the area. They persevered. And they actually still live inside the national park today.
So what are the big issues for the Havasupai tribe today in 2019, where you are in the Grand Canyon?
The top of the list for issues impacting the Havasupai tribe today are uranium mining. The second would be being able to use and get back as much of our Aboriginal territories as possible. We also are working on establishing water rights, which includes getting into communication with either individuals or entities who have a well deep enough that pierces the Red Wall Muav Aquifer. And the Red Wall Muav Aquifer is what fuels the entirety of Havasu Creek. That's our entire water source.
Now, your area, Supai Village, has become one of the big destinations for people who visit the Grand Canyon National Park. For our listeners, if they come and visit, what would you want them to know about the Havasupai tribe and the Grand Canyon and your relationship to it?
Well, I would want them to know that the Havasupai are the guardians of the Grand Canyon. We call ourselves the Havasu Baja, the people of the blue-green water. I would have to mention that this land is sacred and this land has sustained life since the beginning of time, and that we've been trying to protect the land as our destiny, as our calling, as Havasupai people know and already feel that our hearts are buried beneath the land and our ancestors have been walking on this land before us, protecting it for us. So just to give resonance and thanks for being in the area. And as you would make your way to the rim and you park your cars and you get out and you look over the edge, you realize that the world is so grand. And that when you look down into the bottom and you see these green cottonwood trees and you say, wow, there must be water down there. Maybe people used to live down there. Well, in fact, we did. What you will be viewing as Havasupai Garden was farmed by Havasupais. And just to remember that you're on Indian land. I know we share origin stories with many other nations who consider the Grand Canyon the birthplace of their people. But I really want the millions of tourists who come to the Grand Canyon to know that we still live inside the park and we still do our best mm-hmm. to protect the area. And we're happy that the tourists are there. We're happy that they can share the view and the beauty and the magnificence of the area with us. And we've been protecting it this entire time.
That is Ophelia Wadahamidji Corliss, who is a Havasupai tribal councilwoman, joining us from the Grand Canyon. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And tomorrow, our series continues. We'll talk with Jan Balsam, senior advisor to the superintendent at the Grand Canyon National Park, about tribal relations, climate change, and managing the millions of visitors that come to the park every year.
Former White House Communications Director and Trump ally Anthony Scaramucci has had quite a news cycle. Last week, he defended the president but also criticized some of his tweets. That launched a Twitter attack from the president on Scaramucci. And by yesterday, Scaramucci was calmly calling Trump off the rails, calling on Republicans to find a new candidate, and on CNN, criticizing the president's use of Twitter.
He's using the American presidency and the Twitter feed from the American presidency to go after his fellow citizens from the White House, from the presidency, right? And so you guys just think about how disturbing that is. And so for me, you know, he's talking about other people being un-American and they have to go back to places where they came from and stuff like that. Hey, you know, Mr. President, you're being un-American. Bullying is un-American.
Well, for more, let's go to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. With Kara Swisher, editor-at-large at Recode. And Kara, you've spoken in the past with Anthony Scaramucci on your podcast, though not since this break with the president. You know, your sense of what's going on here.
Well, it's interesting. I don't know what changed over that weekend. I think it was the attack from the president, which was pretty straight on for a very minor, slightly disloyal thing to say. But he really wasn't even disloyal. He was just saying he didn't like the racist tweets, essentially.
This is your wheelhouse. Scaramucci told CNN's Anderson Cooper he thinks the Twitter attacks are part of a broader strategy by the president.
And he's lighting up and personalizing this. You know, Anderson, I've got 5 children. This guy's trying to put me in harm's way on his Twitter feed, as he's done to other people. I'm not saying I'm being singled out. I could care less. But the reason he's doing it is not because of me. He's doing it to scare the bejesus out of all those people up on the Hill that hate his guts. You know, they're up there looking at each other, shaking their head. We got to wait this guy out. It's either 15 months or 5 years. They hate his guts. He knows it. They know it. But they're afraid to speak up.
Talk about that, Kara. The president using Twitter as an intimidation tool. Now, some would say, hey, this is a president who, you know, likes to connect with people. Twitter came along at the right time. But Scaramucci's making quite a charge that this is an intimidation tool.
Yeah, it's not a new thing. He did it at the beginning of his presidency against corporations. If you remember Boeing and everybody else, he's like the troll in chief. And he uses Twitter as a tool to do whatever he wants politically. So he's using it both to govern, to campaign, and to take aim at people as a weapon.
Well, also, as we saw recently, to spread unfounded conspiracy theory tweets.
Sure.
Your sense of what this means for future presidencies, for our world, that a president can weaponize something that was supposed to be a form of connection.
Well, was it? I don't know about that. You know, all the things that have happened with Twitter and Facebook and other and social media, it's all been used much more so as a weapon than it has anything else. I mean, literally 18 months ago, I wrote this, that this is a weaponizing tool that it amplifies and it goes to the groups you want to reach. In a lot of cases, he wants to reach his base of people who are on it. And so anybody else just doesn't want to come under that scrutiny. So they keep their mouth shut, even if they disagree. And it's, you know, it's been used by autocratic regimes across the world. Everyone always talks about Twitter, internet being the most open thing in the world. There's nothing autocratic regimes love more than social media because they can use it to abuse and manipulate people.
Well, it has escalated to the point that Anthony Scaramucci is calling on Republicans to replace Donald Trump, saying he's gone off the rails. Trump responded with a tweet saying Scaramucci is only upset that I didn't want him back into the administration and that he wanted to be on TV. You know, I have to, does he have a point in that Scaramucci had this short stint? No. Okay.
No. Here's why. Because this is what he does for, if he did it just for Scaramucci, sure, you can question Anthony. Anthony Scaramucci's motives if you want. I get it. I get that. But you know, he's done it for George Conway. He's done it for others. Everybody's always got it. The whole thing Donald Trump relies on is that we think we're so cynical about people that everyone's got a scam going on. And so the biggest scamster of all time is saying everyone's got a scam, and he makes us all sort of descend into the gutter. Like, it takes away the credibility of what anybody is saying. People benefit when you distrust everybody, people who are trying to manipulate.
Well, Anthony Scaramucci has tried. President Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen, also tried, to no effect. And you also have to think of how what Twitter does is exponentially Xerox, you know, repeat what the president is saying. And there are a lot of people who are following him on Twitter.
Well, the only person who really does effectively counter him on Twitter is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I wrote a column about this. Is she speaks the language of the internet, and especially social media. And so the question is, is this going to skew elections so much so, or is it just a lot of noise? And I think we're going to find that out in the next election cycle. It certainly didn't work in 2018 to talk about traveling bands of migrants. Where did they go? It doesn't always work, and people do get fatigued by this. Whatever you think of Scaramucci, I don't think he's going to back down. And maybe he wants a TV contract. Maybe he doesn't. But it doesn't undercut something he is saying, which is, in essence, is that the president's using Twitter to try to silence opponents in the GOP. And that is a problem. That's a real problem.
That's Kara Swisher, editor-at-large at Recode. Kara, thanks as always.
Thanks a lot.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.